Coming up today, how COVID tracking apps are pivoting for commercial profit, and we talk about the future of genome sequencing. You're listening to the Wired podcast, your essential weekly guide to all the best stories in tech, science, business, and culture. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me this week are Morgan Meeker.
Hello.
Amit Koala.
Hello.
And Matt Reynolds.
Hello.
This was the week when major concerns were raised about data gathered by period tracking apps in the wake of the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade. The ruling, which makes abortion legal in 22 US states, will criminalize the act of seeking abortion services. As such, any data submitted or collected by any kind of app could potentially be used against women seeking an abortion.
This was also the week when, after just a year of operating in Belgium, the delivery app Gorillas made the decision to exit, closing all its warehouses in Brussels and Antwerp and letting go of most of the country's 200 employees. The Berlin-based business has struggled to raise new funds as investors back away from loss-making tech companies.
And it was also the week where poliovirus was detected in sewage water in London, suggesting the first local spread of polio in the UK for almost 40 years. The last case of polio in the UK was in 1984, but routine sewage analysis detected the virus in several samples between February and May this year. And that suggests that there's a localised outbreak that started with someone entering the UK around New Year who might have passed on the virus to a small number of other people, potentially unvaccinated children. So the hunt is on to find out exactly where these cases are, but the sewage samples cover about 4 million people in London, so identifying the source of the virus will be extremely tricky.
And finally, this was the week when the US Food and Drug Administration blocked the sale of Juul e-cigarettes, citing a lack of evidence about any potential health risks. It is a significant blow for the company and for the growing vaping industry in the US.
Before we continue with the show, just a further word on Roe versus Wade. Obviously, this is a huge, huge story and one that we'll continue to cover across Wired. But due to people being out quite a bit this week, we're actually recording the podcast on June 27th, which is Monday. So just a couple of days after the ruling. And we didn't really feel in a position to weigh on in such a harrowing and complicated story. You can read all of our coverage on the fall of Roe versus Wade and the decision's impact on reproductive rights in the United States and elsewhere on wired.com. All right, what did we learn this week? Morgan, I'll come to you first.
So this week I learned that while Japan has this image of being kind of incredibly tech savvy, has a lot of famous tech businesses, its companies that operate there are actually really hooked on dated technology. So almost all businesses there use fax machines. And when Microsoft shut down Internet Explorer on June 16th, it's basically caused chaos because 49% of professionals, according to one survey, rely on the browser for work. So companies that sort of help other companies sort out their tech problems have been inundated with requests for help because government agencies and financial institutions are among the companies that forgot to find an alternative before Microsoft turned off Internet Explorer.
I like this idea of the entire nation of Japan or a good percentage of professionals within it scrambling around to replace Internet Explorer about a decade after most of the rest of the world abandoned it. I mean, the answer is fairly obvious. Head to a search engine of your choice and type in browsers.
Maybe they're waiting. Maybe they have to fax each other advice on what to do next.
Maybe. This is a fascinating story. Did you read about it somewhere else, Morgan? Like what's the source of the 49%?
I read about it. The story was on the Financial Times about how basically the chaos that it's caused and how all these Japanese companies kind of forgot to do anything ahead of Internet Explorer being turned off. And it's quite interesting.
It is. It's fascinating. For the rest of the world, the final death of Internet Explorer was kind of, it felt like a bit of a moment, but it didn't really have any practical ramifications. But yeah, so there we go. In Japan, it caused minor chaos, which is both amusing and slightly unfortunate. All right, Matt Reynolds, What did you learn
this week? I have another story themed around Japanese companies, but kind of accidentally this time. So I learned that the PlayStation 2 console was only discontinued in 2013, which is 13 years after it was first released in 2000, just under 13 years, actually. So this means it has one of the longest production runs of any console. It's being produced almost right up until the moment the PlayStation 4 was released, but it's not the longest running production console ever. That crown goes to the Sega Master System, which was released in 1985 and is still being produced in Brazil 37 years later.
That is an excellent fact. Why, though? Why specifically Brazil, and why such a long run?
Apparently, so this was all to do with Sega taking on Nintendo, and it didn't really kind of catch on worldwide, but apparently Brazil just, it became massively popular there, and actually old consoles are quite popular in Brazil, and it's been produced in lots and lots of different forms. So the current form of the Sega Master System is essentially a very small miniature console with a hard drive that has about 100 games preloaded. So it's not exactly the same as the first version of the system, but it's the same games, it's the same kind of console. But it really took off in Brazil where it didn't in the rest of the world.
Yeah, Brazil was, as you were saying, Matt, somewhere where old consoles are really, really popular. And I think a lot of the PS2 sales that were happening in 2013 were in South America because the games were a lot cheaper. You know, you were looking at like 50 quid for a PS4 game brand new, whereas PS2 games could be gotten for a lot cheaper. And it was also one of the last consoles where you could kind of, you know, crack it and illegally get games for free, basically, which isn't really possible with the newer ones with all the DRM and internet connectivity that's required.
Yeah, and there are various markets around the world, right, where old or oddball versions of consoles are still ridiculously, ridiculously popular, particularly in regions where games companies haven't tended to venture because piracy is so high. So there have been various like alternative versions of Nintendo consoles that have been released in mainland China. So it's not one games industry for us all. Good stuff. All right. Our first story this week is about the COVID data pivot. Matt and Morgan, you both reported a story this week on how COVID tracking apps are pivoting for commercial profit. And this was a story that you both saw bubbling up independently of one another. So what did you spot? And what about it really grabbed you?
Yeah, so during the pandemic, I was actually working for a Dutch magazine called The Correspondent, and I was working on this project where we were documenting all the apps that were introduced all over the world during the pandemic. So the scale was massive. There was contact tracing apps, symptom tracker apps, surveillance apps to make sure you weren't breaking out of quarantine. And even at the start of the pandemic, it was obvious that some of these apps were going to want to pivot at some point. They were sat on all this data, even if that was just data about how users behave.
That's right. And in the UK, one of the biggest of these apps was Zoe, which is a huge initiative that started in late March 2020. And basically, it asked people to report their symptoms in the app. It'd say, you know, do you have a new loss of smell, or do you have new sore throat, or, you know, runny nose, or any of these symptoms that were associated with COVID? And the idea was this would help track new outbreaks and track new infections at a time when there wasn't really very good access to testing. And Zoe was really, really influential and important in the UK. It informed the government response. It got the list of symptoms changed. So it was only because of data from the Zoe symptom tracker that loss or change of smell and taste became a kind of official COVID symptom. And so this ran for, you know, it's been running for almost 2 years or more than 2 years. But in early May 2020, users got an email saying that things had changed in the Zoe symptom tracker app. And this email basically said that the Zoe COVID symptom tracking app was going to become the Zoe health study. And for the first time, it would ask people to input data way beyond their COVID symptoms. So they'd talk about, gut health or, you know, mouth ulcers and things like that. So suddenly, it was a study that was much more about general population health rather than just about COVID symptoms.
May 2022, right? Not May 2020. It's a recent change.
Yes, that's right. This May.
Yep. Gotcha. All right. So let's talk about how Zoe has changed, Matt. As you say, this app was a huge deal during the worst of the pandemic in the UK. And this is a fairly big pivot for it to make.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's hard to really understate how big this app was actually through the last 2 years, but particularly, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic. So we're talking before we had the official contact tracing app from the NHS. We're talking, this app was set up only a few days after the first lockdown went into place. And so to be clear, I mentioned this a little bit, but this isn't a contact tracing app like the NHS app, which says how close is Matt to someone else and did he meet someone else that might have had this virus. This is all about self-reporting your symptoms every day. You log in, you say, I'm feeling great, or I'm not feeling good, as a way to see where outbreaks were taking place. And the idea was that Zoe would communicate this information to the government. They'd use it to kind of just publicize that data, but also track regionalized responses. And actually, the story of the COVID symptom tracker coming into being was kind of pretty exceptional. So this, you know, the team put it together, this team at Zoe and also at King's College London put together this app only about after 5 days of frantic development. So Zoe is this nutrition company that had been developing this nutrition tracking app, but because one of the co-founders, a guy called Tim Spector, was an public health professor at King's College London, he said, hey, look, we can use this to actually track symptoms, so we can kind of pivot this app. So this story all started with a pivot and then ended with another pivot, but they said, let's pivot this app so we can track symptoms instead. And just 10 days after it launched, it had 2 million downloads. And over the pandemic, around 4.7 million people downloaded the app to report their test results and also whether they had symptoms. And this was a huge deal, by far the most widely used app of its kind in the UK. So at its peak, 2.4 million people were tracking their symptoms using this COVID symptom tracker. And it was one of the three surveillance studies the UK government used to track and respond to new outbreaks. And I spoke about that data around loss of smell, meaning the government changed their official symptoms list. And because of all of this, because it's public benefit and because of its involvement with public health, between August 2020 and March 2022, this app and the Zoe team was funded with £5.1 million from the Department of Health and Social Care. So it had quite significant government backing as well.
It's important to note that the pandemic isn't over, but it's definitely faded from view, and as a result, I imagine the way in which people were using and interacting with this app has faded as well. So it would make sense, I suppose, for the people behind it to look at what it might now do differently. But rather than going after COVID in a different way, it's doing something completely, completely different. So how is it changing?
Yeah, exactly. So users of the Zoe app would have found in early May, they got this email that said that the COVID symptom tracker was becoming the Zoe health study. And this basically asked people to do a similar thing, but for a different purpose. So it asked people to take 10 seconds each day to log their mental and physical health beyond COVID. So people who agree to take part in this wider study, even if you have the app, you're not automatically included in this new study. You have to say, okay, I'm going to re-consent to this new way of using my data. They're asked to establish their baseline health. So they report everything from hair loss to mouth ulcers and gut health and all these kind of different things, as well as providing daily health updates. And so the company says that this Zoe, the company behind this, says that the data will be used to fight the most important health issues of our time. So it's got to focus on cardiovascular disease, nutrition, and these kind of big population level health issues. But it also notes that this data might be used to develop commercial health, nutrition, and lifestyle products. Because as I said, Zoe's core business is selling personalized nutrition tests and subscriptions to nutrition plans. So it's basically a kind of nutrition health platform. So this is really quite a big shift into this overall, general health. I should note that they're still doing this symptom tracking, this COVID tracking. So that's going to happen alongside it as well. But as well as this general health study, people are also being asked to take part in specific studies. So at the moment, you can log into the app and say, oh, I want to take part on a study that's involved in identifying early signs of dementia, or on the role of immune health in heart diseases, or one on the gut microbiome. And the thing that all these studies have in common is they're all about reporting your symptoms and reporting how changes in your lifestyle might relate to changes in your general health.
You've kind of hinted at it there, but why might this be controversial or raise eyebrows amongst the millions of people who downloaded this app to track COVID symptoms and now find an email, as you said, asking for them to consent to a different function for the app, but all the same, it's not what the app was designed to do in the first place. So why is that problematic, do you think?
Yeah, there are kind of a couple of things that, I spoke to some ethicists and some privacy experts, and there are a couple of things that we kind of really raised. And one is that the Zovid Zoe COVID symptom study, you know, it really was a way to track COVID outbreaks. And that was a pretty unique situation. And people that are signing up to it, you know, were trying to contribute to this kind of, you know, this big public health emergency that we had. And so there are questions around scope creep here, right? This idea that should an app that sprang up for a public health project now, at least partly, be funneling data towards a private company? So to what extent should the company signpost this change? Should it get people to go onto a different app? Is it okay to just change the name? So the name of the study has been changed within the app, but actually in the app store that hasn't been updated yet. Spectre told me that it just takes a long time for that to be updated. So at the moment it's still COVID symptom tracker on your phone, but actually it's this wider app. And it's worth noting here that people that want to take part in this wider health study do have to re-consent. It's not like they're kind of pulling this data and saying, oh, we've got this and now we're going to use it for that. But it's not so much a question of data as this question of 4.7 million people on this platform. This is huge, you know, resource that, you know, can be used, and people might have, you know, questions about, you know, what this goes to next. There's also this kind of bigger question that this was an app that was government backed, you know, it was kind of promoted by the government, it was funded by the government and certainly endorsed by the government. You know, does that confer something about this app status? And do people think these apps are perhaps more official than they are? Like, do people know that this is an app being run by a private company that now has these different motivations, and have they been sufficiently signposted? So Morgan, you were talking right at the beginning how you put together this list of COVID tracking apps and basically wanted to follow how they developed, you know, what happened to them and how they worked and then how they changed after the pandemic. And when I was looking through that list and I was following up a lot of these regional symptom tracking or contact tracing apps, a lot of these government-backed apps simply shut down. They said, you know, it was there during the pandemic to track outbreaks. We no longer think the pandemic's at its peak, so we don't think this is worth funding. We're going to shut it down. Thank you. We're not going to do anything with that data. And I think some people might say, well, that was the right thing to do. It came for a purpose. That purpose is now changed or is no longer relevant. It's worth noting that, you know, the health department funding has been withdrawn, so Zoe doesn't necessarily have the kind of incentive to do that on behalf of the government anymore. But some people might say that, you know, once the app has finished doing the thing that it existed for, well, it should stop. And if it wants to do this different health study, maybe it should start again with a new user base.
I mean, 4 odd million people is, again, they have to re-consent, but having an app on the phones of 4.7, was it, million people is a pretty good starting point. And even if just a small percentage of those people reconsent, then for citizen science, this is still something that's operating, I would imagine, on a fairly unprecedented scale. And the Zoe Health Study could recruit hundreds of thousands of people to track their health and habits in a way that we've never really been able to do before, at least not so cheaply and easily. So that there is potentially quite an exciting or interesting benefit for how we do citizen science, right?
Yeah, and that's the flip side of it. You know, another way to look at this is the pandemic gave us a great opportunity where everyone got on board with tracking their health. And actually, we've never really had this kind of opportunity to track health at this population level before. So, you know, now the Zoe Health Study has 800,000 participants. And even those smaller studies that I spoke about have hundreds of thousands of participants. And recruiting people for clinical studies is really difficult. You know, would you download an app to track your gut health if you didn't already have that app on your phone? Would you kind of go out of your way to do that? There's just this, you know, quite big barrier to entry. So on a really basic level, these are huge numbers, and getting updated health information through so many people could help us understand things about nutrition and diseases that we don't know about right now. And so Tim Spector, the Zoe co-founder and this King's College London professor, he wants to use this huge database to answer all these questions that he has. So he wants to know, well, what happens when 100,000 people skip breakfast for 2 weeks? And theoretically, you could do that through the Zoe Health Study. You could say, okay, 10% or 50% of our people, we're going to ask you to change your diet and then tell us how that changed your physical health, how that changed your mental health, and then we'll publish a study off the back of that. And that's a new kind of nimble and fast citizen science I think a lot of people find very exciting. But of course, the other side of that is that this data can still be used to inform commercial products. As I said, Zoe sells nutrition tests and nutrition plans. And, you know, it's this kind of part scientific and part, it's about, you know, publishing scientific studies, but it's also about informing these kind of, commercial products as well. So there's this really almost dual aspect thing that's going on. It's saying, well, if you want these great benefits from this huge citizen science project that can do all these kind of interesting academic studies, maybe you just have to accept that actually there is going to be some commercial development off the back of that as well.
Absolutely. And speaking of commercial development, Morgan, Zoe wasn't the only COVID tracking app which was changing in interesting ways as the worst of the pandemic faded from view. So you were looking at Luca, which is a really huge deal in Germany, but it's doing something quite different and it doesn't have anything to do with health.
Yeah, exactly. So when I was talking to Matt about Zoe a few weeks ago, it struck me how similar the situation was to Luca, which I have been following closely. So Luca was one of two major contact tracing apps in Germany. It received millions of euros in government contracts, and in total 40 million Germans signed up. And they were basically using the app to check into restaurants and be informed if they had been exposed to a COVID outbreak. So it was a contact tracing app. It wasn't tracking people's symptoms. But when the government contract started drying up earlier this year, that's when the company started trying to find a new business model to keep the Luca app alive beyond that pandemic. So the idea that the company landed on was a payments app. And in June, it launched a payment function in the existing app. So people could basically go to a restaurant, scan a QR code, see their bill for what they'd just eaten and pay in the app instead of using a card terminal, basically. So they could either put their card details into the app or they could use Apple Pay kind of through the app. And this is quite a bold business decision because Germans notoriously love using cash. So around 46% of Germans still prefer to use cash over card or mobile payments. That's according to a 2021 study by YouGov, the polling company. And just as a point of comparison, in the UK, that number is just over 20% who prefer to use cash over card.
It's an absolutely wild stat about the use of cash in Germany. I had to use like coins. I think I've used notes a couple of times through the pandemic, but I paid for something with spare change for the first time the other day in what felt like probably more than 2 or 3 years. It was just quite odd. So the idea that nearly a majority of Germans still prefer to use cash over cards in this day and age is quite surprising, but I guess there is a need, and the developers of this contact tracing app, Luca, have been quite smart to spot it. And they feel that they're best place to meet it, even given the various troubles that this app had in terms of user privacy and how it handled data during the pandemic.
Yeah, so there's definitely a gap in the market. So no company has yet convinced Germany to give up on cash. And if Luca could do that, that would obviously be very lucrative. But Luca has received a lot of criticism throughout its lifetime. There's been several instances that experts describe as examples of the app's security being compromised. So the first one was in April last year. Researchers uncovered a security gap with Luca's key fobs. Now, these are kind of like small tags that people could use to check into restaurants if they didn't own a smartphone, because that was a big concern at the start of the pandemic. And the researchers found that they could use the QR code printed on the key fob to basically access a person's entire check-in history. And then the second kind of controversy that was caused by the app was a man died outside a restaurant in the West German city of Mainz in November last year. And the local health department basically used the Luca app to access the contact details of 21 potential witnesses who were inside the restaurant at the time. And it handed these details over to the police. So that caused a big uproar in Germany. It was seen as a misuse of the app and kind of a violation of people's privacies. Now, Luca insists that neither of these incidents were a breach in the app's security. It maintains that it's never had a data breach. It's very safe. It's very privacy conscious. They say that the key fob issue was a problem with the key fobs, not the app. The issue in Mainz was basically caused, they say, by the health authorities using the app to basically trick it into simulating a COVID infection, and so they kind of exploited the system. But that has made some people like Bianca Castle, an ID expert I spoke to, really wary about the app kind of remaining in public life. She basically says if Luca wasn't very good at keeping contact tracing data safe, I mean, how can Germany trust it with financial data?
These are two quite different examples of what we're sort of referring to as the great COVID data pivot. You've got Zoe, which is remaining in the health sphere, and you've got Luca, which is trying to turn itself into a German version of Google Pay, or a bridge between Germans who are a little bit uneasy about using mobile payments over cash. But where does all of this leave us? In the piece, you quote Phil Booth from the activist group Med Confidential, who says it was inevitable that businesses and projects that provided services through the pandemic would try and use that prominence for post-pandemic success, which is a fairly good point, right? And we've hinted at it a couple of times as we've talked about this story. There are millions of people, or in the case of Luca, 40 million people with this app on their phone. And there's a risk here that we blur the line between public health and private profit. So is what Zoe and Luca are doing a good thing, or am I right to feel slightly uncomfortable with this sudden shift? Matt, what do you think?
I think it's really difficult, and I share your slight uncomfortableness here, because I think there's one aspect which is about the extent of the pivot. So I think that with Zoe, it's a pivot, but it maybe feels like a natural place to go for like broader population health studies. And so maybe if those people are, you know, if that's adequately signposted and people know what's changing and how their data is being used, then maybe that's okay. With Luca, that feels like maybe a much bigger jump to do. And so that makes me feel maybe a little bit more uncomfortable. But then there's not really a clear line, is there? So would an app that fell between the two of those not be okay? Or would it be, you know, would that be a violation? I think where this leaves me is that perhaps when these contracts are signed up and when private companies take on government contracts or work with the government to do this kind of big public health initiative, perhaps the parameters of that scheme should be signposted a little bit more clearly. And perhaps it's even something like saying, government saying, look, you know, we were involved with this study up until this point, but you've got to know that from this point, we don't have any control over it. It's not part of a government-backed thing. It's not part of this public health initiative. By all means, it may be very worthwhile taking part, but maybe you should just know that it's in a different realm now. And I also think there's this question around, well, if these are beneficial, if this public health study is beneficial, then who's going to make it? You know, if people don't believe that the government is capable, or an academic group is capable of doing this, or it's likely to come out of that kind of platform, maybe we think about new ways. We need to think about new ways that these products can be developed and how they can be done in a way that, you know, signposts people so they know what they're kind of getting involved. So I almost think that what happened is in this really early frantic rush at the beginning of the pandemic, people, you know, did great products and they got stuff out, but maybe they didn't think so much about that long-term end game, because there was going to be a point when the contract ended and where the funding ended. And I think maybe thinking about that end game way back at the beginning might make this feel like less of a pivot and more of an inevitability.
Yeah, I think that kind of moving from a publicly funded to a commercial app is what's making people quite uncomfortable, and people aren't just worried about this from a data point of view, but I mean there's also the competition element as well. I mean, in terms of Luca, there's a payment app in Estonia called Paypolitan, and it's been really vocal about criticizing how Luca essentially has got a head start into the payments market. They basically got startup funding through their contracts with the government to do contact tracing, and now it's able to pivot. It's really prominent, so it's finding it really easy to get investment, and now it's just sort of going barreling into the payments market. But then I guess, I mean, to play devil's advocate, you could argue that the government spent all this money, like this is public money. I mean, why waste it? Why shut down an app that has tried to, as Lucas says, make people's lives easier? Why not make that the foundation for a business that is also trying to do something different or innovative? I mean, that is one argument.
It is an argument, which I guess would be Luca's argument, but maybe not one that stands up to a great deal of scrutiny. I think it, not to get too bogged down in contracts that were signed at the beginning of the pandemic and whatever terms those contracts contained, but I suppose one small lesson that we might learn here is when government funding is used to give a huge boost to a service such as Zoe or Luca, what's the end game for that? And Matt, you were sort of talking about this. What's going to happen with that app at the end of the pandemic? I mean, could a government have put some sort of proviso in the contract that any users gained during a period as a result of government funding cannot be used for X, Y, Z in the event of this app changing, et cetera, et cetera? One would imagine that everybody was panicking so much, rightly, at the beginning of the pandemic, that an awful lot of public money was used unwisely, as we've seen in the UK with the scandal around the procurement of PPE and such like. So there are lessons to be learned here, and it isn't small fry. 40 million people using this Lucca app. If you're a competitor in the mobile payment space, then you're probably a little bit annoyed that, half the population of Germany all of a sudden has a rival payment app on their phone from a company that kind of got to that position in a slightly different way. It's a really interesting story. We'll include a link to the full version in the show notes, as always. And I know we've got a pretty international listener base, including lots and lots of people in Germany. So get in touch and let us know what you think about this COVID app data pivot. podcast@wired.co.uk with your thoughts on that or anything else that we talked about on the show this week, or if you're going back through the archive in past weeks as well.
For our second story this week, we are joined by Rachel Pells, the author of the latest in our series of Wired books. This one is called Genomics: How Genome Sequencing Will Change Our Lives. Rachel, you start the book by explaining some of the amazing progress that's been made in the world of genomics since the first human genome was sequenced, not only in terms of what we're capable of, but also in terms of the falling cost of this sort of work, which is something I was really struck by. How have things kind of changed in the last 20 years or so in this field?
Yeah, it's come on remarkably, actually. It's really, when you think how 30 years ago we didn't actually have a term for genomics, it's still quite a new term. And when scientists kind of got together to create a map of the first human genome, it took them, I think, 10 years and cost something like $3 billion. And now you can just sequence a whole human genome at the click of a button, pretty much, and it won't take more than a couple of hours. So that kind of gives you a sense of how quickly things have changed.
It is really amazing. I think the cost had fallen by a factor of, it was down to less than $300. I can't quite do the maths in my head for what factor that is, but it's just incredible. And, as everyone probably knows, there's, 23andMe and things like that. And, there's full genome sequencing kits that you can get for fractions of the cost that it originally took. And that progress is really opening up the potential of new treatments, particularly for single gene conditions like cystic fibrosis. So this is something you go into in the book, but maybe you could talk about how those treatments for cystic fibrosis work and how far away are we from using this technology to maybe even cure or eradicate a disease like cystic fibrosis?
Yeah, so cystic fibrosis is quite a good example of something that we can quite easily pinpoint in our genome. So it's caused by a defective protein that results from mutations in one particular gene. And because of that, if you imagine you've got a map of all of our DNA, scientists can sort of pinpoint exactly where that fault lies, which means that potentially we could eradicate this gene from our whole gene pool if we wanted to. There have been studies done so far just in mice, not yet in humans, but it's sort of going that way, where researchers have swapped the defective piece of DNA that can lead to cystic fibrosis and replaced it with a healthy sequence. And that's a really significant step because it means that if a person today is born with that mutation, they could undergo what will hopefully be one day quite a straightforward procedure and live a long and healthy life. Obviously, we're not quite there yet, but genomics has, just by having that data means that we can, we've sort of progressed in terms of medication and treatments for it.
Absolutely. And it's not just having the data or being able to map the genome that's enabling us to make these treatments. There's also progress in editing the genome itself, and we have all these tools now for snipping the genome and inserting new genes. So I think one of them is called CRISPR. How does that work?
CRISPR, if you think about it like a pair of scissors, is how they tend to describe it. They can cut a sort of strand of DNA and use that sort of point to edit the DNA to put in a new gene or change the gene, if you like. I'm massively oversimplifying it, but that's sort of basically how it works. It's not perfect. It's still a very new sort of technology, and people do have their sort of reservations about it. It's not entirely precise, so the danger is if we were to use it on humans at the moment, you could accidentally sort of cut the wrong part of the DNA or sort of accidentally affect a wider region than you intended to. So the technology is there. There are some other similar things that are sort of in development. There's something called prime editing, which a lot of people think is potentially safer because it's more precise. But that's, yeah, there are sort of different things that are improving in that regard. But CRISPR is the sort of original, if you like, the way that scientists worked out how to go in and edit and actually change our DNA.
I guess we'll get our scissors again slightly more precise, right, with these new technologies. Miss CRISPR is maybe like a big kind of ribbon cutting pair of shears that you might use to cut the ribbon on a new development. Maybe these new technologies are more like the little scissors you might use for a more delicate operation or something like that. So what about like other conditions? Because there are applications for this technology for things like cancer as well. How can genomics help with maybe cancer treatment or other more personalized forms of medicine?
Because we can map out all of our DNA, we can see where everything lies. And we can also, so what researchers are starting to do is to create a database of how different drugs and different sort of treatments affect different genes, if you like. So from that, we can sort of start to piece together how why one medication affects you differently to me, for example. And the hope there is that as this kind of research progresses, we can start to roll out more tailored medicine in terms of diagnosis, but also the treatments that you get. And that means that hopefully one day, especially when it comes to things like cancer, which is really complicated to treat people for, and people react really differently with different types of medicines, you can sort of look hopefully at your exact personal genetic makeup, and a doctor could say, okay, this medication is much more likely to work for you for this reason. And that the idea is that that will save a lot of time, save a lot of money for the NHS, but also a lot of stress and pain, and make us all hopefully a bit healthier. That's the dream anyway.
Absolutely. And there, I guess there are other we won't go into this now, but there are other technologies that you mentioned in the book as well that use kind of the tumor's own DNA against it, or by, you know, targeting the genetic code of the tumor rather than the body that it's inside. You can kind of target cancer that way as well, but I think we probably won't go into that at this point. I wanted to talk to you about some of the more controversial applications, because, you know, kind of within or adjacent to healthcare, there's a kind of growing number of companies offering genetic screening of embryos. And I was really struck by like the amazing range of things that we can now predict, or that these companies claim they can predict about people just from their DNA.
Yeah, so we've all heard of designer babies. I think that is probably the most famous or well-known thing that we think of when we think of gene editing in humans. It's kind of becoming a reality, I think. There's a couple of companies, there's one in particular called Genomic Prediction, which it's a service that provides genetic testing for would-be parents going through IVF. And essentially they can take a couple's embryo and they can use genetic sequencing data from the parents and also from the embryonic cells to determine that embryo's particular risk of carrying inherited diseases like heart disease, diabetes, certain cancers. And they can take all of that information and create a sort of health score called a polygenic risk score, which the parents could then use as a basis for selecting which embryo looks the healthiest and in theory select it to go forward with their IVF process. And on paper, it's great. Studies by this company, Genomic Prediction, show that children born through the service have like a 46% lower risk of heart attack, 42% less chance of getting type 2 diabetes. But it's obviously a little bit controversial because it does sort of open the door a little bit wider to this idea of designer babies. If we can select for one thing, like potential health prospects, we could very easily select for something else more aesthetic, like hair colour and eye colour. So it sort of leads to lots of big ethical questions, and we don't know all the answers just yet.
Yeah, something that comes up in this a lot is this question of like, and to be fair, this is a thing that comes up in a lot of technology discussions that we have on the podcast, is this question of kind of where do we draw the line? You know, where do we draw the line between what's acceptable in terms of screening? Okay, it's totally acceptable to screen for Down syndrome or, you know, Edwards syndrome. We do that all the time. Cystic fibrosis, maybe people would put that in a similar bucket because it's this life-limiting disease that we might want, you know, if we're choosing an embryo, we might want to choose an embryo that isn't at risk of having that condition, for example. But with other stuff, as you say, it's a little bit more of a grey area. And I think we're probably, I mean, maybe I'm assuming things, but I would think most people would maybe have a problem with embryos being chosen based on hair colour or eye colour or something like that. So, but then not everyone shares those views. So I guess my question is, how are countries trying to work their way through these thorny issues and figure out what approach to take when it comes to genomics? How are they trying to figure out what best represents the kind of view of the people, as it were?
Yeah, it's a tricky one because, like we said, we don't really know exactly how we could be impacted by all these changes. It's still a really new concept and something a lot of people don't know a huge amount about, quite understandably. And like you say, I mean, it's easy for, I think, perhaps some scientists to say, and some people to think on paper, okay, great, if we can eradicate a condition like cystic fibrosis, then we should. But a lot of people who live with that condition would say, well, actually, I wouldn't change anything. My life is very valuable, and you know, people with differences contribute a lot to society. So it's really unclear sort of how we're going to go forward with this. So at the moment, Genomic Prediction, which is the company I mentioned that's doing this embryonic screening service, they will only allow parents to screen for health, not for anything else, aesthetic, you know, skin colour, hair colour, intelligence, all of those things. They will only show the data that reveals the sort of forecast of the embryo's health. They have the potential, though. They have the data there. They could show the parents if they wanted to. They say that they won't because that's a clear line to them. But there's no regulation. There's nothing stopping people from doing this. And like with any sort of business opportunity, I suppose, as this technology becomes more mainstream, there's a huge potential for other groups to sort of pop up and potentially take advantage of couples, especially when it comes to the sort of people who want to conceive.
Absolutely. So in the UK, we've taken an interesting approach to this with a sort of citizens assembly where a group of people are going to get together and I guess just thrash it out, like what we want the regulation to look like and what we want this landscape to look like in future. And I guess how you balance that desire for better medical outcomes with this desire not to do anything, and I guess too beyond the pale or whatever. You raise a really important distinction in the book between individual kind of genome editing for people, like I guess this would be the case with cystic fibrosis treatments for someone who has already been born, but then there's also something else called germline editing. So can you talk me through the difference and why that matters?
There's two different types of gene editing. There's germline editing, which is when changes are made to the DNA in embryos or the sperm or the egg cells. And that's where the inheritable genetic code lies. And that has an impact on the future generations because the changes are passed on. That is not currently allowed in most of countries that regulate this. You can't edit embryos themselves, certainly not outside the lab anyway. The sort of more common, if you like, more widely accepted form of gene editing is somatic. And that involves editing the DNA in a sort of fully formed human. So that would be changes that you might make in a surgical procedure, if you like, to somebody after they've been born. And those changes won't be passed on to their descendants because it's not within their germline. And the reason why that's not currently allowed, the germline editing process, is because we just simply don't know the consequences much further down the line. We don't know what those impacts could be. By changing one tiny thing, it could have lots of other impacts that we just can't predict.
this is why, and listeners might remember this story from a few years ago, because I think we talked about it on the podcast at the time. This is why the Chinese scientist He Jiankui got in so much trouble, because he had gene edited the germline of these two babies that were born to try and treat them, make them, I think, more resistant to HIV infections. But it was this germline editing that was really kind of beyond the pale and what ended up with him kind of going to prison. Rachel, with all the, I'm interested, with all the kind of work you've done on the book and all the people you've spoken to, I'm interested where you kind of land on this like thorny ethical question, you know, how you think the ideal future of this looks like. How are we going to regulate this stuff?
Yeah, it's a super interesting question. There's not really an easy answer. I think, and something that Stephen Xu, the founder of this embryonic screening service, said to me is that, and he's right, that the genie is kind of out of the bottle. You know, once the technology exists, you can't wish it away. We just have to, I think, be really open about it, transparent about what's being done, and try and involve the public more. So something that you mentioned, something that's happening in the UK later this year, is there's going to be a citizens' jury, which is essentially a sort of group discussion. They are bringing in different sort of patients who have different conditions, people who are not necessarily experts, so not scientists, to just talk through the different implications, how they feel about it. And the idea is they're going to use those discussions to inform some of the policy around it. Whether or not that's a perfect system, I don't know, but it's kind of a right step. I think the best that we can do is, yeah, just talk about these things really openly and not roll out things too quickly, if that makes sense. I think this is a classic example of something where the science and the technology is kind of moving along so quickly, it's really overtaken our human understanding of it. So it's something we'd have to just be careful about.
Absolutely. Well, let's have our own citizens' jury of Wired podcast listeners. Do let us know what you guys think about this, because it's a really, really interesting topic, and one I think where there's going to be a really wide kind of range of views. So we'd love to hear some of them. If you have any views on this, let us know at podcast@wired.co.uk. I want to say thank you to Rachel for joining us, and a reminder that Genomics, How Genome Sequencing Will Change Our Lives, is out now at all good bookstores.
Thanks to Amit and Rachel for that. And we've got time for one of your emails before we go this week. Linda, who I assume is from Australia, writes in about funeral trains after Natasha's fact about London's Necropolis Railway last week.
Yeah, that's right. Linda writes that there's another beautiful and still standing funeral train station in Sydney, Australia. So these were, if you don't remember or didn't listen to last week's episode, the trains that were used to ferry caskets from cities like Sydney or London or San Francisco to places where there was more room to bury them when the cemeteries in their cities filled out. So when you catch trains in and out of Central Station in Sydney, you go past this station. When it operated, it used to carry the departed and their mourners to Rookwood Cemetery, which I assume used to be on the outskirts of Sydney, but by a glance at Google Maps is now firmly within the city limits of Sydney. So really interesting to know that there's more than one mortuary train, and Natasha will be delighted to hear that when we let her know. Thanks, Linda. And if anyone wants to look up this station, it's called Mortuary Station.
And it looks very pretty. A nice day out for anyone in Sydney or happens to be travelling to the area. If you have a thrilling fact about funeral trains or anything else, podcast@wired.co.uk. We'd love to hear from you if you want to get in touch with the show. All right, that's it for this week. We'll be back again same time next week. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.